Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Built down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm going to get on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about. And today, hopefully today, we are going to fly through a bunch of articles. I'm not going to hit the high and the low points. I'm just going to try to clear a bunch of articles that are piling up on my desk, which means I'm not going to do a deep down in-depth analysis of each individual study, and although there are many flaws in them, I will try to keep my rants to a minimum. And with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good, it is good, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? The first article I want to talk about comes in Diabetes Care. It is titled Hospitalization for Lactic Acidosis Among Patients with Reduced Kidney Functions Treated with Metformin or Sulfonylureas. What we know about metformin is that there is an increased risk of lactic acidosis. However, this risk is usually widely overstated, overblown, over-exaggerated, and there is a wonderful article by James McCormick titled The Contraindications to Metformin Should Be Contraindicated, and I would recommend everyone go read it. However, in this article, the U.S. Veteran Affairs System, they identified individuals with GFRs less than 60 or had their serum creatinine raised to greater than 1.4 if you were a man, or 1.5 if you were a woman. They compared 25,000 metformin users and propensity matched them, so they tried to match them up as best as possible to 25,000 sulfonylurea users. And then they looked at hospitalizations for lactic acidosis. And what did they find? They found there was no real difference in the hospitalization rates for lactic acidosis. However, for me, the problem here is that they didn't look at the subgroup that was less than 30 mLs, the GFR of less than 30. That's what we all want to know. I don't think anyone, hopefully at this day and age, has a problem continuing metformin or starting metformin on anyone who has a GFR greater than 30. It's the continuing when they're less than 30 that makes people pucker just a little bit. So do the trial that we all want to see, or don't do the trial that we don't care to really see. Look at the group that's less than 30 GFR, or don't look at any group, because we know, as the US FDA approved back in 2016, that the real risk, even with a slight renal decline with metformin, is not as serious as we once thought that it was. So, I guess the take home in this trial is that metformin therapy is safe for patients with mild to moderate reductions in the renal function. But it's not the study that we all wanted, because officially we should have all already known that. So we're still waiting for the trial or the study that looks at the GFR less than 30. And this did not answer that. On to the next article. And the next article I want to look at also used propensity matching. I've talked about propensity matching before, but it's basically when you can't do a randomized control trial and you try to match up the two groups as best as possible. You try to match them by age, location, sex. You try to match them by everything that you possibly can, and then it's like a fake pseudo-randomization, although nothing really does beat randomization. This next article is titled Association of Low-Value Testing with Subsequent Healthcare Use and Clinical Outcomes Among Low-Risk Primary Care Outpatients Undergoing an Annual Health Examination. My problem with the annual health examination, the annual physical, if you will, is that it really does nothing for us. It grants us nothing. Here's what we know about the annual health physical. Insurance pays for it. Almost everyone gets it, and it really does no good for the patient sitting in front of us, except for cause us to order more tests. And in this study, it couldn't be more clear. The researchers from Canada used claims data to evaluate individuals who were low risk and underwent an annual health exam between 2012 to 2016, and they propensity matched individuals who had these tests done, these tests I'm going to tell you about, compared to individuals who did not have these tests that I'm going to tell you about done. And then they looked to see what was the cause of having these tests done. What was the cause of having, a chest x-ray? What was the cause of having, an EKG, or maybe a Papa Nicolau, a Pap test when you are low risk, because everything that we do has its risk and benefits. And if you are a low risk individual, then likely, just likely, the benefit that you're going to get from a test is not nearly as beneficial as you think that it may be. So let's break down their findings. They found that out of 100 patients that came in that were propensity matched over 90 days, those individuals that were low risk and had chest x-rays, even though they were low risk for cardiovascular or pulmonary disease, they had one extra pulmonary consult and two CT scans per 100 individuals. Now remember, the CT scans come with radiations. The pulmonary consult also comes with maybe a repeat follow-up pulmonary consult to look at what maybe AKA suspicious. And even if it doesn't, it requires that low-risk individual taking time out of their day to make another appointment, to go to another office visit, to pay another copay. It is all risk. And when these individuals are low risk, we're really not seeing true benefit here. Likely, we're seeing true harm. But what about the individuals that were at low risk for cardiovascular disease, the individuals that were low risk and had EKGs performed, resulted in another two cardiology consultations, resulted in six extra echocardiograms, and resulted in five extra stress tests. I can't say that all these tests were unneeded or all these consults were not needed, but when you're low risk and your baseline is low risk and you're screening healthy individuals, it is really, 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 really hard to find anything that does benefit. That's why our screening tests don't really work like we wish that they would. That's why mammograms don't really save lives, because we're screening healthy people. They are healthy, low-risk individuals, and it is really hard to find benefit when the baseline individual is already at low risk. And what about the women out there that were low risk, age from 13 to 20 or greater than 69? They were low risk for any vaginal or cervical abnormalities, but those individuals or those women that underwent a Pap test, well, it was associated with two extra gynecological consults, 53 extra follow-up Pap test, and one extra colonoscopy. This is per 100 women. Per 100 women that are low risk, it's associated with 53 extra Pap tests in the future. It is almost certain that we are doing harm when we do these extra things to the extra low risk individuals that come into our office for the maybe not necessarily ever needed health examination. With that, on to the next article. Now, the last article talked about something that everyone wants to work, which is the health examination, which is why insurance probably still pays for it. Speaking of something else that everyone really wants to work, how about vitamin D? Well, if it's not another study looking at vitamin D in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology Metabolism titled Effective Vitamin D Supplementation on the Incidence of Diabetes Mellitus. In this study, they looked at a whole bunch of individuals and they say, does vitamin D supplementation prevent type 2 diabetes? And they found, by gosh, that if you gave over 1,000 international units per day, it prevented type 2 diabetes. Oh my goodness, let's quickly break down why I think that they're wrong. You see, they're saying it's only over 1,000 international units. Fine, if you want to throw out lower than 1,000, if somehow at 999 this doesn't work anymore, and it only works at 1,000 over, fine, I'll grant you that. If you want to look at statistical significance, which is what they were looking at, the confidence interval goes up to 0.99. And I don't know what the next numbers are after 0.99, because maybe it was like 0.97, and if you're going to do a true rounding, that would then make it go to 1. But if it goes to 1, let's be honest, then it's not statistically significant, then you can't get your paper published, so who's ever going to say that? No one. No one's ever going to say that. That's my second problem with it. It goes to 0.99, which realistically means it's probably not a real signal. And last but not least is that when they looked at this, the results were not affected by age. Okay, I find that hard to believe, because we know that the vitamin D levels change with age. Wasn't affected by sex. It wasn't affected by formulation. It wasn't affected whether you took it daily or you had bolus dosing. That also doesn't make any sense. We know from, if you're going to believe in vitamin D literature, we know from the other literature that bolus dosing and daily dosing are two totally separate things. So to say, well, it doesn't matter which one you get, because either one prevents type 2 diabetes, I find that a little fishy. And last but not least, the one thing that I really find super hard to believe is that the results were not affected by the pre-treatment vitamin D level, which means they're saying it didn't matter if your baseline vitamin D level was 5 or your baseline vitamin D level was 500. It just mattered that you took this pill either in daily or bolus formation that then prevented type 2 diabetes. I mean, come on, people. If you were going to say that this actually worked, if you believe that this actually works, then you believe it works because you're giving vitamin D, which then increases your vitamin D levels. But if it doesn't matter your baseline, if it doesn't matter if you were deficient or not deficient, then are you really saying that, oh, look, this must work because it's raising... No, come on. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. And I'm throwing this paper or this journal or this article out with the rest of my conclusions about it. So let's move on to the next article, which is titled Association of Cardiovascular Disease Risk Burden with Progression of Coronary Atherosclerosis Assessed by Serial Coronary Computed CT, or CT angiography, as is better widely known. This was in JAMA Network Open July 24th, and here's what they did. They took a bunch of patients, about 1,000 in total, and then they risk stratified them to an ASCVD risk score of less than 7.5, 7.5 to 20, or high risk greater than 20% on a 10-year ASCVD risk score. Think about this for a second before I give you the results. A 20% 10-year risk on that ASCVD risk score. That is the ultimate hypertension, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic. That has everything written all over it if they haven't already had an event. I mean, this is someone who is at high risk for an event in the future coming 10 years. Well, when they did repeat coronary CT angiography, you would not believe what they found. You wouldn't believe what they found if I gave you $1,000. They found that if you were in the high risk group, this group that had already over a 20% risk on the calculator, well, then you were at more risk, or you were at higher risk of developing adverse plaque characteristics and were significantly more likely to be in the high risk group or high risk lesion group. Can you believe it? Can you believe that a calculator that said you are already at 20% risk, you are already at a 1 in 5 risk of having a major adverse cardiovascular event in the next 10 years, that those individuals then on imaging would have abnormal imaging? This is shocking. The authors go on to state that maybe, just maybe, that we should use coronary computed CT angiography, this coronary CT angiography, to help us as providers tell us what this ASCVD risk score means. Because if you couldn't figure out that a 20% risk at 10 years is a really high risk factor and that individual should already be making lifestyle changes, well then just maybe, yes, maybe you need to use a coronary CT angiography to help you figure out what this risk calculator even means. Blah. I can't believe that the study was done, and I can't believe that the authors are saying that, look, we need to use this test. No, we just use the calculator. 20% at 10 years. You're a 1 in 5 risk of having a major adverse cardiovascular event at 10 years. You don't need any higher risk than that. That tells you exactly what you need to know. With that, on to the next article, which is an article I recently got asked about. It is titled Randomized Placebo-Controlled Trial Effects of Aspirin on Dementia and Cognitive Decline. This is in Neurology 2020, July 21st, and this was a breakdown of the ASPRE trial. The ASPRE trial, if I take you back all the way back to 2018, took 19,000 older adults, median age 74. They gave them aspirin 100 milligrams or placebo for 5 years, and they found out that aspirin did not lower the rates of disability-free survival, dementia, or adverse cardiovascular events. It was one of three trials in 2018 that put a complete halt on aspirin for primary prevention. Well, the participants in this trial underwent a whole bunch of tests at the beginning and the end of the trial, which then let the researchers take a closer look at this whole cognitive outcomes, because maybe, just maybe, there was no change in the incident dementia, but maybe they could find like a little twitch or a little something in there that say, well, look, it wasn't nothing in the incident dementia, but it slowed the rate of future progression, or, you know, what have you. But it turns out there was no difference. In the end, the incidence of mild cognitive impairment was 2% in both groups. It didn't matter if you had aspirin or placebo. And I will tell you, placebo is probably a lot cheaper without any harms. And the cognitive decline was 9% in each group. It really didn't matter which group you're in, placebo or aspirin, but this is just another trial that adds on to the 2018 data that we had that says aspirin for primary prevention of any kind of any sort should not be used. End of story. Period. Next article. And this next article hits particularly close to home, at least for me. And you'll see why in a second. It is titled, "Both New and Chronic Potentially Inappropriate Medications Continued at Hospital Discharge Are Associated with Increased Risk of Adverse Events." This is in the Journal of American Geriatric Society, and they looked at close to 2,500 older adults, 65 years of age and older, over a two-year period that were released from the hospital, and they looked to see how many inappropriate medications were they on. They used the inappropriate medications coming from the BEERS list or the Geriatric Society BEERS criteria on medications that are inappropriate for those in the elderly. And if you left the hospital with an inappropriate medication, well then bad things happen to you, my friend, because for each additional inappropriate medication prescribed at discharge, it was associated with 21% higher risk for an adverse drug event within 30 days of discharge and a 13% higher risk for an emergency department visit, rehospitalization, or death. This is no bueno. We want to do the best for our patients when they leave the hospital. Some of the medications that they're on, I don't necessarily agree with, but I continue them because their primary care doctor should follow up and maybe wean them off or wean them onto. Some of the medications I prescribe at discharge are because that's sort of what the patient was on while they were in the hospital. But we know that what the patient has or does in the hospital, it doesn't necessarily translate to what they're going to look like on the street. I mean, after all, how often are we checking someone's vitals 4, 5, 6 times a day when they're on the street? Maybe, just maybe, we are over-testing, over-diagnosing, and over-treating. And by the looks of it, from this paper, we are definitely over-prescribing when it comes to discharge. But speaking of overprescribing, this next article I want to talk about, titled "Effect of Antihypertensive Medication Reduction Versus Usual Care on Short-Term Blood Pressure Control in Patients with Hypertension Age 80 Years and Older, the Optimized Randomized Clinical Trial," talks about just that, which is, in the primary care setting, how often are we overprescribing antihypertensive medications? In this UK study of almost 600 patients age 80 years old or older who were taking two or more hypertensive drugs, they were randomized either to deprescribing or to usual care. In the deprescribing group, as you can imagine, the goal was to deprescribe the medications. And then the medications were reinstated if the systolic blood pressure rose above 150 millimeters of mercury or the diastolic blood pressure was above 90 millimeters of mercury for greater than 1 week. And at 12 weeks of follow-up, the proportion of patients with a systolic blood pressure less than 150 was almost exactly the same in the two groups. Almost identical in the two groups. But there was one thing that was not identical, my friends, and that is about two-thirds of the patients that were in the withdrawal group, two-thirds of the patients that were in the deprescribing group maintained basically their same hypertension blood pressure control with one fewer antihypertension medication. So, blood pressure the same, one less medication. You tell me who's really winning in this situation. And with that, let's close this thing up before this ship sets sail in the sea of evidence. So let's wrap this thing up and then we'll end this podcast as we've ended every single one before it. In case you were wondering, metformin is still safe to use in individuals with moderate kidney disease. But if they have a CKD less than 30, can you use it? Should you stop it? Well, we don't really know because the study didn't really look at that, but it confirmed our already confirmation practice bias that it is safe to use down to a GFR of about 30. And if you have a patient that has a high ASCVD risk score, like a really high ASCVD risk score, 20%, well, then you should really probably not do anything other than get them on a statin. The fact that there is even a push or a suggestion or a hint that we should use other tests like a coronary CT angiography or any other calcium score, blah, 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 to help us improve our predictive value of a calculator that's already telling us we have a 1 in 5 chance for a major adverse cardiovascular event at 10 years. I mean, that is high enough, my friends. We don't need any higher, or we don't need any more information to tell us what we need to do with that patient. Unless, of course, you forget to do it, which may happen if you have cognitive impairment. Unfortunately for us, in primary prevention, aspirin does not prevent any kind of cognitive impairment. So if you're using that on your patient to prevent cognitive impairment, then go ahead and stop. I think we can all say from now on, officially, for primary prevention, aspirin can be stopped for just about everything. And other things that can be stopped, well, or at least stopped for most individuals, that is the EKG, the chest x-ray, or the Papanicolaou test, or the pap smear, for those individuals that are low risk during the annual health exam. Realistically, we could probably just stop the annual health exam altogether, but that's another conversation for another time. So, if you have a low risk individual, you are doing more harm, you are causing more future tests, and you are causing more future workup by doing these low-risk tests on low-risk individuals. The key to questioning medicine, though, is to keep questioning everything you do, like giving vitamin D to prevent type 2 diabetes. Yes, there is a paper that says if you give vitamin D over 1,000 international units, then you will prevent diabetes. However, in my take of the literature, there is almost no way that this is true. And if you want to know why, go back to my take on it. There is just too many flaws in the study, and I think we all should question medicine just a little bit more. And speaking of questioning medicine, if you have a patient leaving the hospital, well, then consider trying very hard to try to resist the urge to prescribe any medication that are on the Beers list or any of the elderly contraindication medication lists. The main reason being that for every drug that an elderly person is prescribed that comes off this list, they are at significantly higher increased rates of return to hospitalization or having some sort of serious adverse side effects. So consider not prescribing the medication. And speaking of not prescribing the medication, if you look at a whole bunch of elderly individuals and you then randomize them over 12 weeks to then a deprescribing or continuing to prescribe mode for their high blood pressure medication, most likely you will see that you can actually take one medication away almost completely and they still maintain the same blood pressure. It makes us all question, what are we doing? And should make us all question, is the medication we're writing for actually needed, whether that be in the hospital or out of the hospital. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.